Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen from the WNYC and Gothamist Newsroom, filling in for Brian Lehrer, who's got the day off. We hope he gets some better weather soon. Coming up on the show today, we'll be talking about the implications of all these flash storms and the flooding. Did you see the flooding around the city over the weekend? Well, all that water has to go somewhere, and it has already affected last weekend's New York City triathlon. Plus, we'll be talking to New York City Council member for the 39th District in Brooklyn, Brad Lander. He's the apparent winner of the city controller's Democratic primary. Then later in the show, we'll get some helpful cooking tips that don't require heat from Vaughn Vreeland. But to start, an update on the ongoing situation in Haiti after the assassination of their president last week. Last Wednesday, Brian spoke to Gary Pierre-Pierre of the Haitian Times about the breaking news. It's been almost a week since then, and over 20 people have been arrested for the murder. We'll hear more about that. The Biden administration has also responded to a request for reinforcements and has sent a team of FBI and Homeland Security officials to Haiti, but refused to send requested military assistance for now. Haiti's troubled history goes deep, from colonialism to independence, then years of occupation and crushing debt, plus suffering more than two decades of brutal dictatorship in just the last 200 years. Then, after a powerful earthquake devastated the country in 2010, an influx of foreign aid and peacekeeping forces appeared to only worsen the country's woes and instability. Joining us now to look at Haiti's history and how it can inform what's happening now is Marlene Dout, professor of African Studies and African Studies at and African American Studies at the University of Virginia. She specializes in Caribbean, U.S. African American, and French colonial literary and historical studies. Also from Haiti is Catherine Porter, Toronto bureau chief for the New York Times and author of A Girl Named Lovely, about the experience in Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. Thank you for joining us, Professor Dout and Catherine. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having us.
Hi, nice to be here. Nice to be talking to you too, Marlene.
Nice to see you too, or see you virtually, rather.
Catherine, I'll start with you. For listeners who are catching up on this story, can you tell us about what happened last week, starting with the assassination early Wednesday morning?
Well, early Wednesday morning, around 1 a.m., neighbors of the president, who lives in a pretty plush suburb of Port-au-Prince, awoke to gunfire, and some of them awoke to the sounds of a loudspeaker, someone saying that it was the DEA and not to shoot and to stay in their homes. They heard explosions, and soon after, they learned that the president had been assassinated. There's not much known about, you know, what happened. Later on that morning, the Justice of the Peace came in and found the president in his bedroom, covered in blood, filled with at least 12 bullet holes. It looked like his place had been pillaged. They were looking for something, he said. And the hunt was quickly, you know, on for what seems to be, or at least what the government says, is a group of mostly Colombian former military men or some acting that were here. And we're not, you know, there's lots that we still don't know about this story. The government says that these are the culprits. They are the ones that have been found, and they were swiftly found. Not just by police, but also by the population in small quartier populaire, like the small poorer areas of the city that cling to the mountainsides. People were basically finding these guys and bringing them out. And so we're at a point now that there still are some at large, but we don't really know what this was about and why these Colombians were here. Were they really the ones behind the attack? Why would these guys not have an exit plan? They seem to be just running down the street about a kilometer or a mile or so from the president's house. They did not make it far. There's just lots of questions we don't know the answers to.
Catherine, some of the reports allege that the president was tortured before being assassinated. What do we know about that? And what does that tell us about the motivation here?
Well, we don't know that to be truth. It's hard here. You have to realize that there's been very little information coming out from the police at this point during the investigation. They're hosting news conferences in which the chief of police speaks for only maybe 7 or 8 minutes. So the information is coming out very slowly. And so in the void, which Marlene will tell you, I'm sure, is something called the telejol, the rumor mill. And we don't know. There were photos of the president's body at the morgue circulated on WhatsApp a couple days ago all over, as well as X-rays purported to be of his body. We don't know for sure that the X-rays are real. We couldn't get confirmation from anyone in the government that they are real. They do show a broken bone, but it could be from a bullet wound. We have talked to forensic experts who say that he didn't show signs of torture, but we just don't know. We're at the beginning here. You know, the president certainly had enemies. He had enemies. He had made some enemies among some of the very wealthy, powerful people here. He, there had been said to be links with gangs. There's huge civil protest against him. You know, who knows who's behind this and why they would torture him if they did. But we really don't have that evidence yet. We have to wait.
And Catherine, just one other question about the what happened last week. The First Lady of Haiti was also injured in that attack. Has there been any update to her condition?
Yeah, the interim prime minister said the other day that she was stable. She's in a hospital in Miami. His government has said that that there was a Twitter voicemail put out on her account where she was saying that she was in hospital and saying that the assassination had happened because they wanted to silence the president's voice and his mission. No one's entirely sure if it was her, but the government said that was her. And so, you know, if that's the case, she's spoken out once. We understand she's going to speak out again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, according to the prime minister, the threat of her to her death is no longer a threat. She's stable.
Okay. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Are you from Haiti or of Haitian descent? What is your reaction to the news of the president's assassination? And where do you think Haiti goes from here? Call us at 646-435-7280 or tweet at Brian Lehr. Also, what are you hearing from friends and family in Haiti? Help us report the story. Again, the number is 646-435-7280. Professor Dout, Haiti's history is interesting because of the first ruler of Haiti, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, a leader of the Haitian Revolution against French colonial rule, was also assassinated in the early 19th century. What are the ripple effects for a country when the person who led them to freedom is murdered?
Yes, so Haiti gained its independence from France on January 1st, 1804. Very quickly, Dessalines became at first governor general of the state of Haiti. He soon thereafter named himself and was nominated as emperor. So by the fall, he had been crowned emperor of Haiti, and they had set up an empire, even though it was, sort of the limits were the island itself. They did have designs to reunify the eastern side of the island that is now the Dominican Republic. And so actually that conflict between the western part of the island and the eastern part of the island existed in Dessalines' era and is one contributing factor to the reason for which he was assassinated. The interesting thing about the parallel with this situation is that Dessalines was assassinated on October 17th, 1806, And we still don't really know who did it, who was there at Pont Rouge on that day just outside of Port-au-Prince, but we don't know exactly who plotted and planned it. So two of Dessalines' rivals, one Alexandre Pétion and another Henri Christophe, who was actually the head of his army, were quickly accused. They accused one another, and this led to a huge fracturing and split of the island into then three parts. The eastern side were France and then Spain was occupying, and then Henri Christophe became ruler over the north, and Alexandre Pétion set up a republic in the south, and that was in 1806, 1807, and that's when Haiti had a first black republic. So that's the first time there's a Republic of Haiti.
Mm. And then in the aftermath of that, years later in 1825, the French demanded that this newly independent country pay what I understand to be the equivalent of $21 billion U.S. dollars to the French government and French slaveholders. How long did it take for Haiti to pay that bill, and what's the legacy of such debt for such a long time?
So that debt was agreed to, in quotation marks, by a later Haitian president, Jean-Pierre Boyer, who not only reunified the north and the south, but also the eastern side of the island. So at that time, Haiti was the entire island of Hispaniola, which is the name that Spain had given to the island in the 16th century. So Haiti did finish paying off the debt with the interest in 1947. The latest estimates by the French economist Thomas Piketty put the amount closer to $28 billion U.S. Wow. dollars. And there are some estimates that reach as high as $40 billion. And the reason for that is one part of it was the indemnity for the former slaveholders, quote unquote, to be compensated for the loss of their plantations and the labor and their proceeds from that. But the other part was that Haiti was forced to give France most favored nation status, which meant that they traded with Haiti at lower tariffs, and other nations that had been great partners of Haiti, like Great Britain, traded at higher tariffs. So Haiti ended up losing a lot of money. And this meant that that money wasn't poured into infrastructure and roads and schools, all projects of both Henri Christophe and Alexandre Pétion. Boyer levied very draconian taxes on the Haitian people. He told them that these taxes were for the price of their freedom. And that legacy continued on and on and on. And we can only wonder if that money had not been siphoned out of Haiti, whether or not we would be in this situation today.
And then flashing forward even more so, the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 until 1934. Professor, why was that, and how did the occupation affect the country at that point?
So this is, again, another parallel, because President Sam, who was president of the country in 1915, only for a few months, actually, he was wildly unpopular. He was accused of many crimes. The Haitian people sought his resignation, and he fled to a foreign embassy, to the French embassy, and he was dragged out of the embassy and he was murdered. And so some people call it an assassination. There's a little bit of quibbling about whether or not he was actually still president of Haiti at the time of his death. And this assassination became the pretext for the United States to occupy the country for 19 years, an occupation that lasted from 1915 to 1934. That was couched as kind of being for Haiti's own good, since there was sort of mayhem, according to the U.S. government. But what happened during the occupation was what has happened during subsequent occupations. There's been protests against it. There were deaths during the opposition of Charlemagne Perrault in 1919, not only his death, but that of 3,000 other Haitians who opposed the occupation. And so we see that even though there is this history of unrest and presidential assassinations or deaths while in office, that the response of the international community to those issues has not necessarily made things better. The occupation is seen as the watershed event in Haitian history, because once again, Haitians largely interpreted that as bringing colonialism back, the colonialism that they fought and died for in previous generations.
I want to bring one of our callers into this conversation, Jay in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Welcome to WNYC, Jay.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
and tell us what's your reaction to what's been happening and what's your perspective on this story?
So, you know, Haiti's been kind of a mess for a really long time. I'm a Haitian American. And I just wonder why Haiti hasn't done better. I feel like when our Western powers want a nation to succeed, it usually does. I think of places like Japan, you know, that was destroyed and yet they were able to rebuild and they're one of the most prosperous countries in the world. And I think about, you know, a lot of the European countries that were destroyed during war. And all of them, well, not all of them, but a lot of them have rebuilt and they're very prosperous countries now. And I wonder if there's something else, you know, with Haiti that a lot of these Western countries just don't want us to succeed. I know you spoke about, you know, the debt that was placed on the country by France. Excuse me, I'm getting nervous. But
You're doing great.
If you could just maybe talk about that and tell me what you guys think about that, because I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thank you.
Jay, thanks so much. Professor Doubt, what is your response?
I mean, I think the caller essentially, you know, kind of answered his own question, that it is very true that what it seems like is that the rest of the West, because Haiti is actually an integral part of the West, not just geographically, but geopolitically, and hasn't seemed to want Haiti to succeed. So President Boyer, you know, he agreed to this indemnity, again, in quotation marks, because he thought that not only would France then recognize Haitian independence, but that the U.S. and Great Britain, Haiti's trading partners, would as well. And that's not what happened. In fact, Great Britain didn't recognize Haitian independence until 1838, after slavery was fully abolished in the British Caribbean colonies. And the United States waited until after the Civil War had started in 1862 to recognize Haitian independence. So very quickly, we see that, you know, that the world was not on Haiti's side, because they were the first ones to abolish slavery, and England and the United States wanted to keep slavery, as did the Netherlands and Spain and Portugal. And so, of course, they were not on Haiti's side, and they continue to this day to largely exhibit evidence that they are not in Haiti's corner.
Catherine, what's your response
to
the caller?
It is really telling, you know, that not only did, I mean, Haiti was a real threat to the world. This is a free black republic at the height of slavery, and also not just a free black republic. It had been the richest colony in the world. It produced more than half of the world's sugar that was at least exported, and coffee at the time. It was considered basically a gold rush. So it was a huge blow for France, but it was also a real symbol of that was very terrifying to Western powers. I mean, what is interesting to me today is that you mentioned Japan. I mean, Japan's a member of the G7. We don't think of them the same way. But, you know, Haiti, the influence of foreign actors today in Haiti is huge. You will see that, you know, when the president does his press conference, the prime minister does his press conference, and this is one of, you know, the interim prime minister, Claude Joseph, he signals really, really early on. He'll say at the very beginning, you know, I got off the phone with our friends, the Americans, and they sent their sympathy, and, you know, I got off the phone with our friends, the Canadians, and he's signaling that the international community is behind him, because the international community, which, you know, in Haiti, it's known as a core group of ambassadors, they are incredibly powerful on who gets to stay in power. You have to remember, like, you know, when the end of Duvalier, he was whisked off in a plane to France. Then he had, you know, Aristide was taken twice. The second time he said he was kidnapped. Préval, who's a much more recent president and who was, you know, a real exception in that he died in the country peacefully, he also said that after the earthquake, the powers to be came to him one night and said, you know, you need to leave the country. We need to get you out. And he refused. So there is a real Bigfoot influence of international players here. And, you know, your question, the big question that I always ask is why? Why is that today?
Well, we will continue to explore that question and take more of your calls after this short break. You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. I'm Bridget Bergen, filling in for Brian today. I'm speaking to UVA professor Marlena Dout and Catherine Porter from the New York Times about the crisis in Haiti. I want to go back. We've gone through some of the historical challenges the nation has faced, but we cannot overlook one of the most pivotal recent challenges, and that's obviously the 2010 earthquake. Catherine, you were among the journalists who arrived in Port-au-Prince shortly after it struck. What do you remember about that time?
I don't think you could talk to anyone who was here, you know, particularly not a Haitian, but even a foreigner who came in, that wouldn't get teary at the memory. I mean, the damage was so overwhelming. I remember, you know, I flew in at night. It was dark. There was no electricity. And so we were driving, and a lot of the roads were full of rubble. And people were sleeping on the roads because they were fearful of aftershocks, very rightly so. So they were lined with bodies. As some of people right on the road, and other people had moved their whole neighborhood, like, onto the roads. The destruction was just unimaginable, like incomprehensible in a way for your to take in. And, you know, the horror of it was many people who died, because help couldn't get there. The neighbors were digging. I've met many heroes in their neighborhoods who were masons, and they went out with sledgehammers to try and break the walls. You know, Haiti, at some time historically, a lot of these homes were made out of wood, but because of hurricanes, they've shifted to concrete, and there's too much sand in the concrete. So a lot of the concrete just sort of basically, it spilled like sugar off of rebar and tumbled down. And it wasn't only the poor, the neighbors and the poor, up on the mountains, but the rich. I mean, the fanciest hotel in Port-au-Prince pancaked, called the Matana. More than 100 people died there. So the destruction was just enormous. In the first days, there wasn't enough help coming in terms of medical help. Many of the hospitals were badly damaged, or there wasn't electricity, and doctors had been hurt. When many of those doctors that were performing surgeries were doing kind of Civil War era surgery without large amounts of anesthetic. I came in, and one of the first stories I did was at this little makeshift clinic near the airport. It was in basically just inside a sweatshop area, and people were stitching up kids without anesthetic. People were sleeping in tents. It was a very emotional time.
And Professor Dout, there has been an alleged $13 billion in foreign aid in its aftermath that has gone to the country that has allegedly gone missing. What do we know about what happened to that funding?
I mean, so many things went wrong with the sort of aid response, the international aid response. I mean, so there's the question of missing funds that happened at multiple levels. Even, for example, the Red Cross, there were questions about what exactly they did with all of this money that they were given. But a lot of the aid groups did things like bring rice and bring water bottles and flood the market with products from the United States, which made it pretty impossible for Haitian farmers to sell their products, things like shoes also, for example. And so what looked like helping really actually created a lot of harm. And there are a lot of scholars who talk about Haiti as the land of 10,000 NGOs because of this. And anyone who visited the country between, I would say, 2010 and 2018, when the Petro-Caribe protests happened, and then when Payee Lock happened. So in between that time, the vast majority of travelers on the planes were actually religious organizations or aid workers. And so you saw this huge kind of disaster tourist industry crop up that had sort of always been there to a certain extent. But the money, the biggest things that you could see that happened in Haiti, if you want to talk about where money actually, you saw exhibits of it being used, was in hotels. I get mm-hmm. Hilton Hotel or Marriott Hotel and the Best Western. And this is not exactly mm-hmm. going to help the majority of the Haitian people, is having these, you know, big hotel, U.S. hotel chains come to the country.
I want to bring in another one of our callers, Howard from Brooklyn. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to say what happened to Haiti, it should be concerned a lot of people. Without Haiti's fight, all black around the world could have a better chance. All women could not have a better chance. All Latinos could not have a better chance. Remember, Haiti fought against English, French, and Spanish in order to break the chain of slavery for everyone to have mm-hmm. a better life. Before Haiti fought, black people in many places used to live only for 7 years. And there is a little group in Haiti came from around Middle East. It's just a little group. They don't want the country to go nowhere except mm-hmm. from death. Hmm. They are corrupted the government, everything.
Hmm.
They own almost everything in the country. If anyone tried to invest, they send somebody to kill you.
Mm. Howard, thank you so much for calling with that perspective and, you know, the challenges that people are facing there on the ground. I know, Catherine Porter, we are going to lose you soon. You need to go and continue reporting on the ground. But before you go, can you tell us, we know you are in Port-au-Prince now, where your reporting is headed. What will you be following up on today and going forward?
I can't necessarily scoop myself on
without scooping
on
yourself,
national
of course.
Right. Well, look, you know, obviously there's many things here. There's big questions. You know, who are these guys that came? Where were they staying? What were they supposed to be doing here? You know, so we'll be following that story, trying to track that down. The power struggle that's going on, we haven't mentioned, but there's, you know, when the president was shot a couple days before, was assassinated, he had announced a new interim prime minister. I think it was his sixth. And that guy was supposed to, the neurosurgeon, he was supposed to take power that week. So mm-hmm. there's a real power struggle between him and the guy that was there before, who was Claude Joseph, who was a foreign minister at the time, and the head of the Senate. I mean, there is no parliament here. There are 10 sitting senators left in the legislature. There's no lower body. There's only 10 out of 30. So 8 of those 10 have come together, and they believe that the head of the Senate, the president of the Senate, he's the one who should be in charge. So there's a power struggle happening right now, and that's also why you hear each of those people talking about the support of the United States. They're all jockeying for who will support them. We're going to have to follow that story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting what the caller just said about what, you know, this bourgeoisie. This is something you hear in Haiti all the time, but it does pose a bigger question, which is who is going to benefit from this? Who had the most to gain, or at least who had the least to lose if this president mm-hmm. was gone? And that's another question that I'm asking myself, and I hope that my reporting can help contribute, find the answers.
Well, Catherine, we will certainly be following your reporting, and thank you so much for joining us. Professor Dowd, you still have a few minutes with us, and we have some more callers who will join us, but we want to thank Catherine for her time and let her go to start some of that great reporting. I'm going to have another caller join us. Let's have Eddie from Nassau County. Eddie, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I would say, first of all, thank you to the professors for intervening on the case. I think that they have a clear idea of what had happened in Haiti and what is happening now. Literally, I would say, and that what happened this time with this assassination just reminds us what happened at the beginning with this Amin. I'm not trying to compare President Moïse to this Amin, no. But what I'm saying is that's the same tragedy that Haiti is going through.
Mm-hmm.
It has been going through forever. It's like a curse. I think that the callers before me, I think they also explain clearly our situation. We are like, the nation that other nations, let's say, the superpowers, usually, they don't like us.
Mm.
Because if they did, they would really help us. Could you imagine right now in Haiti, you have the United Nations over there, okay? And what they did, they have federated gangs.
Right.
Could you imagine that would happen here in the States? You have gangs running literally the country.
Eddie, thank you so much for your call. Your line's a little hard for us to hear, and we want to get in one more caller. James from East Orange, New Jersey. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, how are you doing today, Bridget?
Great. You have a question for Professor Doubt?
Yes, I do. Actually, it's more of just a point of view. I'm Haitian American, first generation to really come to the country and everything. And I left Haiti when I was 5 years old during the Aristide, as he says, kidnapping. And one of the most interesting I know, going through the education system, I majored in history in college, and my goal was to learn about my country. It's the only reason I really did it. And there is a double narrative to Haiti. Most of what we see is concentrated in the south, around the capital. Towards the north, it's pretty much more prosperous. I learned my grandfather, he owned land out there, cultivated it, and sold goods and everything. There are Haitian oligarchs there, as we call the bourgeoisie. Mm-hmm. And there are big companies such as the BG Group, who have even offices operating in the United States, that is, it's a major contributor to the economy. So my thing is, it gets a little frustrating when I just hear about, the economic disadvantages of Haiti, and personally knowing that there is, there is an economic advantage there. There is that mm-hmm. it can be cultivated. And mm-hmm. if it is cultivated, right, it can assess such damages like, the indemnity that we had to pay and everything else. And that's just what I wanted to bring across.
James, thank you so much. Professor Doubt, what do you make of that sort of delving into the complexity that is mm-hmm. the country's economic history?
Yeah, well, thank you to the caller the idea. One of the frustrating things is to see Haiti, this term used when really people mean a lot of times what's happening in the capital, in Port-au-Prince. And so I often say, that Haiti is not just Port-au-Prince. There are other parts of the country where other things are going on that don't necessarily revolve around gang violence and the sort of economic disruptions that we've been seeing in the last few months. But I will say that what has been very interesting about the protests that started around the Petrocaribe funds, where are the Petrocaribe funds, the Côté Côte Petrocaribe campaign, that when Pays Lock, the lockdown of the country started, and this was grassroots Haitians saying, no, we're not going to contribute to the economy, we're not going to keep things running unless we have some answers, then we started to see that what happened in the capital actually did end up happening elsewhere in the north, for example, in Cap-Haïtien. The other thing I would say is something about what Catherine Porter was talking about with the power struggle between Ariel Henry, Claude Joseph, and Joseph Lambert. The other part of that power struggle is with the Haitian people. Because again, another frustration of mine is to see headlines about Haiti asks the U.S. for assistance. Well, no, that's not exactly true. There are reports that that Claude Joseph asked the United States for assistance, but the vast majority of Haitian people, if you take a look at social media or involved in any WhatsApp chat rooms, Haitians are largely, Haitian civil society groups are saying, no, we do not want UN troops. We do not want US intervention. And so if that US and UN delegation is to have any meaningful effect on changing the future and the narrative of Haiti, they need to have at the table Haitian civil society groups, people who represent the members of the Haitian populace, not the Haitian elite, because the three men vying for power, again, want the power for themselves. It's just more elite men, as both callers just spoke about, wanting to keep the power for themselves with their own interests. And how would things happen and come out differently if the Haitian people really the ones driving the conversation about what needs to happen next and who needs to be in charge? And maybe that means that there are multiple people, a different way of organizing society needs to happen. When will the Haitian people have a voice that is not revolving around an election and the ballot box?
Thank you so much. We're going to have to leave it there for now. But my guests have been Marlena Doubt, professor of African American and African Studies at the University of Virginia. She specializes in Caribbean, U.S. African American, and French colonial literary and historical studies. And earlier, Catherine Porter, Toronto bureau chief for the New York Times and author of A Girl Named Lovely. Thank you so much for being here, Professor Doubt. Just really, really helpful and fascinating context for what we will continue to follow is happening on the ground in Haiti.
Thank you so much for having me and for doing this report.
I'm Bridget Bergen from the WNYC and Gothamist Newsroom, filling in for Brian Lehrer. Coming up next, how more frequent heavy rainstorms, which are connected to climate change, are affecting our infrastructure and the water quality in our local waterways. Stay with us.